tiny sign popped up on the wide, flat horizon. I knew exactly what it would say. Welcome to Kinnickey, heart of America, in 1950s cursive. It did, and I could just make out a spray of bullet holes in the bottom left-hand corner where Runner blasted it from his pickup truck decades before. Then I got closer and realized I was imagining the bullet holes. This was a tidy new sign, but with the same old script. Welcome to Kinnickey, heart of America. Sticking with the lie, I liked it. Just as I passed the sign, another one arrived. Kinnickey, Kansas State Penitentiary, next left. I followed the direction, driving west over land that was once the Evely farm. Ha, serves you right, Evelys, I thought. But I couldn't remember why the Evelys were bad. I just remembered they were. I slowed to a crawl as I drove down this new road, far on the outer edge of town. Kinnickey had never been a prosperous place. It was mostly struggling farms and optimistic plywood mansions from a preposterously brief oil boom. Now it was worse. The prison business hadn't saved the town. The street was lined with pawn shops and flimsy houses, barely a decade old and already sagging. Stunned children stood in the middle of grubby yards, trash collected everywhere, food wrappers, drinking straws, cigarette butts. An entire to-go meal, styrofoam box, plastic fork, styrofoam cup, sat on a curb, abandoned by the eater. A scatter of ketchupy fries lay in the gutter nearby. Even the trees were miserable, scrawny, stunted, and stubbornly refusing to bud. At the end of the block, a young, dumpy couple sat in the cold on a Dairy Queen bench, staring out at the traffic like they were watching TV. On a nearby telephone pole flapped a grainy photocopy of an unsmiling teen, missing since October 2007. Two more blocks and what I thought was a copy of the same poster turned out to be a new missing girl, vanished in June 2008. Both girls were unkempt, surly, which explained why they weren't getting the Lizette Stevens treatment. I made a mental note to take a smiling, pretty photo of myself, in case I ever disappeared. A few more minutes and the prison appeared within a big, sunburnt clearing. It was less imposing than I'd pictured, the few times I'd pictured it. It had a sprawling suburban look to it, could be mistaken for some regional offices of a refrigeration company, maybe a telecommunications headquarters, except for the razor wire that curlicued around the walls. The looping wire reminded me of the phone cord that Ben and my mom always fought over toward the end, the one we were always tripping on. Debbie was cremated with a little starburst scar on her wrist because of that goddang phone cord. I made myself cough loudly just to hear something. I rolled into the lot, the poured tar surface wonderfully smooth after an hour of potholes. I parked and sat staring, my car crinkling from the drive. From just inside the walls came the murmur and shouts of men taking their rec time. The vodka went down with a medicinal sting. I chewed a piece of hardened spearmint gum once, twice, then spit it into a sandwich wrapper, feeling my ears get booze-warmed. Then I reached under my sweater and undid my bra, feeling my breasts whoosh down, big and dog-eared, to the background noise of murderers playing hoops. That's one thing Lyle had advised me on, stuttering and careful with his words. You only get one chance to get through the metal detector. It's not like at the airport. There's no wand thing. So you should leave everything metal in your car. Including, with women, I think, is it underwire? In the bras? That could be a problem. Fine, then. I stuck the bra in my glove compartment and let my breasts roam free. In the interior of the prison, the guards were well-mannered, as if they'd seen many instructional videos on courtesy. Yes, ma'am. Right this way, ma'am. Their eye contact was without depth. My image bounced right back at me, hot potato. Searches, questions, yes, ma'am, and lots of waiting. Doors opened and shut as I walked through a series of them, each shifting in size like a metal wonderland. The floors stank of bleach, and the air smelled beefy and humid. Somewhere nearby must be the lunchroom. I suffered a nauseous wave of nostalgia, picturing us day kids and our subsidized school meals. The bosomy, steamed women yelling "free lunch" toward the cash register as we came through with a dump of stroganoff and some room-temperature milk. Ben had good timing, I thought. Kansas's disappearing, reappearing death penalty was in moratorium when the murders happened. Here I paused at my jarring new mental phrasing, "when the murders happened," as opposed to "when Ben killed everyone." He was sentenced to prison for life, but at least I didn't get him killed. Now I stood outside the smooth, submarine metal door of the visitation room, and then stood longer. "Nothing to it but to do it, nothing to it but to do it," Diane's mantra. I needed to stop thinking family thoughts. The guard with me, a stiff blonde man who'd spared me small talk, made an "after you" overture. I swung the door open and shoved myself inside. 5 booths sat in a row, one occupied by a heavy-set Native Indian woman talking to her inmate son. The woman's black hair speared down her shoulders, violent-looking. She was muttering dully to the young guy, who nodded jerkily, the phone close to his ear, his eyes down. I sat 2 booths away and was just settling in, taking a breath, when Ben shot through the door like a cat making a break for the outside. He was small, maybe 5'6", and his hair had turned a dark rust. He wore it long, sweeping his shoulders, tucked girlishly behind his ears. With wire-rimmed glasses and an orange jumpsuit, he looked like a studious mechanic. The room was small, so he got to me in 3 steps, all the while smiling quietly, beaming. He sat down, placed a hand on the glass, nodded at me to do the same. I couldn't do it. Couldn't press my palm against his, moist against the window like ham. I smiled milkily at him instead and picked up the phone. On the other side of the glass, he held the phone in his hand, cleared his throat, then looked down, started to say something, then stopped. I was left looking at the crown of his head for almost a minute. When he looked up, he was crying, 2 tears from both his eyes trickling down his face. He wiped them away with the back of a hand, then smiled, his lips wavering. "God, you look just like Mom," he said all at once, getting it out, and coughed, wiped more tears. "I didn't know that." His eyes flickered between my face and his hands. "Oh, God, Libby, how are you?" I cleared my own throat and said, "I guess I'm okay. I just thought it was time I came and saw you." "I do sort of look like Mom," I thought. "I do." And then I thought, "My big brother," and felt the same chesty pride I'd had as a kid. He looked so much the same, pale face, that day knob of a nose. He hadn't even grown much since the murders, like we both got stunted that night. My big brother, and he was happy to see me. "He knows how to play you," I warned myself. Then I set the thought aside. "I'm glad. I'm glad," Ben said, still looking at the side of his hand. "I've thought about you a lot over these years, been wondering about you. That's what you do in here, think and wonder. Every once in a while someone will write me about you, but it's not the same." "No," I agreed. "Are they treating you okay?" I asked, stupidly. My eyes glazed, and suddenly I was crying, and all I wanted to say was, "Sorry, I'm sorry, I'm so sorry." Instead, I said nothing, looking only at the constellation of acne scattered around one corner of Ben's lips. "I'm fine, Libby. Libby, look at me." My eyes to his. "I'm fine. I really am." I got my high school degree in here, which is more than I ever probably would have done outside. And I'm even partway to a college degree. English. I read fucking Shakespeare. He made the guttural sound that he always tried to pass off for a laugh. Forsooth, you dirty bugger. I didn't know what that last part meant, but I smiled because he was waiting for me to smile. Man, Libby, I could just drink you in. You don't know how good it is to see you. Shit, I'm sorry. You just look like Mom. Do people tell you that all the time? Who would tell me that? There's no one. Runner's gone, don't know where. Diane and I don't talk. I wanted him to feel sorry for me, to float around in my big empty pool of pity. Here we were, the last of the days. If he felt sorry for me, it would be harder to blame me. The tears kept coming, and now I just let them. Two chairs down, the Indian woman was saying her goodbyes, her weeping just as deep as her voice. You all by yourself, huh? That's no good. They should have took better care of you. What are you, born again? I blurted, my face wet. Ben frowned, not understanding. Is that it? You forgiving me? You're not supposed to be nice to me. But I craved it. I could feel the need for the relief, like setting down a hot plate. Nah, I'm not that nice, he said. I got a lot of anger for a lot of people. You're just not one. But, I said, and gulped down a sob like a kid. But my testimony, I think I may, I don't know. I don't know. It had to have been him, I warned myself again. Oh, that, he said, like it was a minor inconvenience, some snag in a summer vacation best forgotten. You don't read my letters, huh? I tried to explain with an inadequate shrug. Well, your testimony. It only surprised me that people believed you. Didn't surprise me what you said. You were in a totally insane situation. You were always a little liar. He laughed again, and I did too. Quick, matching laughs, like we'd caught the same cough. No, seriously, the fact that they believed you? They wanted me in here. I was going to be in here. That just proved it. Fucking little 7-year-old. Man, you were so small. His eyes turned up to the right, daydreaming. Then he pulled himself back. You know what I thought of the other day? I don't know why. Thought of that goddamn porcelain bunny, the one Mom made us put on the toilet. I shook my head, no clue what he was talking about. You don't remember that? The little bunny? Because the toilet didn't work right. If we used it twice in an hour, it stopped flushing. So if one of us crapped when it wasn't working, we were supposed to close the lid and put the bunny on top, so no one else would open the lid and see a toilet full of crap. 'Cause you guys would scream. I can't believe you don't remember this. It was so stupid. It made me so mad. I was mad I had to share a bathroom with all of you. I was mad I lived in a house with one toilet that didn't even work. I was mad about the bunny. The bunny. He broke into his confined laugh. I found the bunny, like, it humiliated me or something. Unmanned me. I took it very personally. Like Mom was supposed to find a car figurine or a gun figurine for me to use. Man, I would get so worked up about it. I'd stand there by the toilet and think, I will not put that bunny down. And then I'd get ready to leave and I'd think, God damn it, I gotta put the bunny down or one of them's gonna come in here and all the screaming. You guys were screamers. Hi, eee! And I don't want to deal with that, so fine, here's the goddamn bunny on your goddamn toilet. He laughed again, but the memory had cost him. His face was flushed and his nose was sweaty. That's the kind of stuff you think of in here. Weird stuff. I tried to find that bunny in my memory. Tried to inventory the bathroom and the things in it. But I came out with nothing. A handful of water. Sorry, Libby. It's a strange memory to throw at you. I put one tip of my finger near the bottom of the glass window and said, "That's fine." We sat in silence for a bit, pretending to listen to noise that wasn't there. We had just started, but the visit was almost over. "Ben, can I ask you something?"
"I think so."
His face went blank, preparing. "Don't you want to get out of here?"
"Sure."
"Why don't you give the police your alibi for that night? There is no way you were sleeping in a barn."
"I just don't have a good alibi, Libby. I just don't. It happens."
"Because it was like 0 degrees out. I remember." I rubbed my half finger beneath the counter, wiggled my two toes on my right foot.
"I know, I know. You can't imagine."
He turned his face away.
"You can't imagine how many weeks, years, I've spent in here wishing I'd done it all differently. Mom and Michelle and Debbie might not be dead if I'd just been a man, not some dumb kid hiding in a barn angry at Mommy."
A tear splashed onto the phone receiver. I thought I could hear it. Bing!
"I'm okay being punished for that night. I feel okay."
"But I don't understand. Why were you so unhelpful with the police?" Ben shrugged his shoulders, and again, the face went death mask.
"Oh, God, I was such an unconfident kid. I mean, I was 15, Libby. 15. I didn't know what it was to be a man. I mean, Runnersure wasn't helpful. I was this kid no one paid much attention to one way or the other. And here, all of a sudden, people were treating me like I scared them. I mean, presto changeo, I was this big man."
A big man charged with murdering his family.
"You want to call me a stupid fuck, Libby? Please, go ahead. To me, it was simple. I said I didn't do it. I knew I didn't do it. And, I don't know, defense mechanism? I just didn't take it as seriously as I should have. If I'd reacted the way everyone expected me to, I probably wouldn't be here. At night, I bawled into a pillow, but I played it tough when anyone could see me. It's fucked up. Believe me, I know it. But you should never put a 15-year-old on a witness stand in a courtroom filled with a bunch of people he knows and expect a lot of tears. My thoughts were that of course I'd be acquitted, and then I'd be admired at school for being such a badass. I mean, I daydreamed about that shit. I never, ever thought I was in danger of ending up like this."
He was crying now, wiped his cheek again.
"Clearly, I've gotten over whether people see me cry."
"We need to fix this," I said, finally.
"It's not going to be fixed, Libby. Not unless they find who did it."
"Well, you need some new lawyers working on the case," I reasoned. "All the stuff they can do with DNA now?" DNA to me was some sort of magical element, some glowing goo that was always getting people out of prison. Ben laughed through closed lips, the way he did when we were kids, not letting you enjoy it.
"You sound like Runner," he said. "About every 2 years I get a letter from him. DNA! We need to get some of that DNA! Like I have a locker full of it, and I just don't want to share. DNA!"
he said again, doing Runner's crazy-eyed head nod. "You know where he is now?"
"Last letter was care of Bert Nolan's group home for men somewhere in Oklahoma. He asked me to send him $500 so he could continue his research on my behalf. Whoever Bert Nolan is, he's ruining the day he let goddamn Runner into his home for men."
He scratched his arm, raising his sleeve just enough for me to see a tattoo of a woman's name. It ended in Ollie or Allie. I made sure he saw me notice.
"Ah, this old flame. We started as pen pals. I thought I loved her, thought I'd marry her. But turned out she didn't really want to be stuck with a guy in prison for life. Wish she'd told me that before I got the tat."
"Must have hurt,"
It didn't tickle.
I meant the breakup.
Oh, that sucked too.
The guard gave us the 3-minute signal, and Ben rolled his eyes.
Hard to decide what to say in 3 minutes. 2 minutes, you just start making plans for another visit. 5 minutes, you can finish up your conversation. 3 minutes?
He pushed out his lips, made a raspberry noise.
I really hope you come again, Libby. I forgot how homesick I was. You look just like her.
Patty Day, January 2, 1985, 11:31 a.m. She'd retreated to the bathroom after Len left, his livery smile still offering something unsavory, some sort of help she knew she didn't want. The girls had flooded out of their bedroom as soon as they heard the door shut, and after a quick, whispery caucus outside the bathroom door, had decided to leave her alone and go back to the TV. Patty was holding her greasy belly, her sweat turned cold. Her parents' farm, gone. She felt the guilty twist of the stomach that had always made her such a good girl. The constant fear of disappointing her folks. Please, please, God, don't let them find out. They had entrusted this place to her, and she had been found wanting. She pictured them up in the clouds of heaven, her dad's arm around her mom as they looked down on her, shaking their heads. What in the world possessed you to do such a thing? Her mom's favorite scold. They'd have to move to an entirely different town. Kinnicky had no apartments, and they were going to have to cram into an apartment while she got a job in some office, if she could find one. She'd always felt sorry for people who lived in apartments, stuck listening to their neighbors belch and argue. Her legs puddled, and suddenly Patty was sitting on the floor. She didn't have enough energy to leave the farm, ever. She'd used the last of it up these past few years. Some mornings she couldn't even get out of bed, physically couldn't make her legs swing out from under the covers. The girls had to drag her, yanking her with dug-in heels, and as she made breakfast and got them ready for school, she daydreamed about dying. Something quick. An overnight heart attack, or a sudden vehicular clobbering. Mother of four run down by a bus. And the kids adopted by Diane, who would keep them from lying around in their pajamas all day and make sure they saw a doctor when they were sick, and snap, snap at them until they finished their chores. Patty was a slip of a woman, wavery and weak, quickly optimistic, but even more easily deflated. It was Diane who should have inherited the farm, but she wanted none of it, had left at 18, a joyful rubber band trajectory that had landed her as a receptionist at a doctor's office 30 mere but crucial miles away in Shiburton. Their parents had taken Diane's leaving stoically, as if it had always been part of the plan. Patty could remember back in high school, them all coming to watch her do her cheerleading thing one wet October night. It was a 3-hour drive for them, deep into Kansas, almost Colorado, and it rained lightly but steadily the whole game. When it was over, Kinnicky lost. There on the field were her 2 gray-haired parents and her sister. 3 solid ovals, encased in rough wool coats, all rushing to her side, all smiling with such pride and gratitude you'd have thought she'd cured cancer, their eyes crinkled behind 3 sets of rain-speckled glasses. Ed and Ann Day were dead now, had died early but not unexpectedly, and Diane was now a manager in the same doctor's office and lived in a mobile home in a tidy trailer park bordered with flowers. "It's a good enough life for me," she'd always say. "Can't imagine wanting anything different." That was Diane. Capable. She was the one who remembered little treats that the girls liked. Never forgot to get them their yearly Kinnicky T-shirts. Kinnicky, Heart of America. Diane had fibbed to the girls that it meant magical little women in Indian. And they'd been so gleeful about it that Patty could never bring herself to tell them that it just meant rock or crow or something. Diane's car horn intruded on her thoughts with its usual celebratory honk, honk, honk. "Diane!" screeched Debbie, and Patty could hear the three girls racing toward the front door, could picture the massive pigtails and muffin bottoms, and then imagine them still running, straight out to the car, and Diane driving away with them, and leaving her here in this house where she would make everything go silent. She pulled herself off the floor, wiped her face with a mildewy washcloth. Her face was always red, her eyes always pink, so it was impossible to tell if she'd been crying, the only advantage to looking like a skinned rat. When she opened the door, her sister was already unpacking three grocery loads of canned foods and sending the girls out to her car for the rest. Patty had come to associate the smell of brown paper bags with Diane. She'd been bringing them food for so long. That was the perfect example of the fall short life Patty had made. She lived on a farm, but never had enough to eat. "Got them one of those sticker books, too," Diane said, flapping it out on the table. "Oh, you're spoiling them, Dee." "Well, I only got them one, so they'll have to share. So that's good, right?" She laughed and started making coffee. "You mind?" "Of course not. I should have put some on." Patty went to the cabinet to find Diane's mug. She favored a heavy cup the size of her head that had been their father's. Patty heard the predictable spitty sound and turned around, pounded the blasted coffee maker once. It always stalled after its third drool of coffee. The girls came back in, heaving bags up on the kitchen table, and, with some prompting from Diane, started to unpack them. "Where's Ben?" Diane asked. Patty said, scooping 3 teaspoons of sugar into Diane's mug. She motioned to the kids, who'd already slowed their cupboarding of cans and were peering up at various angles of pretend nonchalance. "He's in trouble," Michelle exploded gleefully. "Again." "Tell her about his, you know what," Debbie nudged her sister. Diane turned to Patty with a grimace, clearly expecting a tale of genital mishap or mutilation. "Girls, Aunt Dee got you a sticker book. Go play with it in your room so I can talk to your mother." Diane always spoke more roughly to the girls than Patty did. It was Diane playing the pretend gruff persona of Ed Day, who'd rumble and grumble at them with such exaggerated fatigue, they knew even as kids that he was mostly teasing. Patty added a beseeching look toward Michelle. "Oh boy, a sticker book," Michelle announced, with only slightly overdone enthusiasm. Michelle was always happy to be complicit in any grown-up scheme, and once Michelle was pretending she wanted something, Libby was all gritted teeth and grabby hands. Libby was a Christmas baby, which meant she never got the right amount of presents. Patty would hold one extra gift aside, and happy birthday to Libby. But they all knew the truth. Libby got ripped off. Libby rarely felt less than ripped off. She knew these things about her girls, but she was always forgetting. What was wrong with her that these bits of her children's personalities were always surprising her? "Want to go to the garage?" Diane asked, patting the cigarettes in her bosom pocket. "Oh," was all Patty answered. Diane had quit and returned to smoking at least twice a year every year since she was 30. Now she was 37, and she looked much worse than Patty did, the skin on her face diamonded like a snake. And Patty had long learned the best support was just to shut up and make her sit in the garage, just like their mother had with their dad. Of course, he was dead of lung cancer not long after his 50th. Patty followed her sister, making herself breathe, getting ready to tell Diane the farm was gone, waiting to see if she'd scream about runners' reckless spending and her allowing runners' reckless spending, or if she'd just go quiet, just do that single nod. "So what's up with Ben's you-know-what?" Diane said, settling into her creaky lawn chair, two of the crisscross straps broken and hanging toward the floor. She lit a cigarette, immediately waving the smoke away from Patty.
"Oh, it's not that. It's not anything weird. I mean, weird, but he dyed his hair black. What does that mean?"
She waited for Diane to cackle at her, but Diane sat silent. "How's Ben doing, Patty? In general, how does he seem?"
"Oh, I don't know. Moody."
"He's always been moody. Even when he was a baby, he was like a cat, all snuggly one second and then the next. He'd be looking at you like he had no idea who you were."
It was true. Ben, at age 2, was an astonishing thing. He'd demand love outright, grab at a breast or an arm. But as soon as he had enough affection, and that came quickly, he'd go completely limp, play dead until you let him go. She'd taken him to the doctor, and Ben had sat rigid and tight-lipped, a stoic, turtle-necked boy with a disturbing ability to withhold. Even the doctor seemed spooked, proffering a cheap lollipop and telling her to come back in 6 months if he was the same. He was always the same.
"Well, moody's not a crime," Patty said. "Runner was moody."
"Runner is an asshole. Not the same. Ben always had that remove to him."
"Well, he is 15. Patty started and trailed off. Her eyes caught a jar of old nails on the shelf, a jar she doubted had been moved since their dad's time. It was labeled Nails, in his long, upright handwriting on a scrap of masking tape. The garage had an oily concrete floor that was even colder than the air. In one corner, an old gallon jug of water had turned to ice, busted its plastic seams. Their breath hung thick with Diane's cigarette smoke. Still, she was oddly contented here, among all these old tools she could picture in their dad's hands. Rakes with bent tines, axes of every length, shelves packed with jars filled with screws and nails and washers, even an old metal ice chest, its base speckled with rust, where their dad used to keep his beer cold while he listened to ball games on the radio. It unnerved her that Diane was saying so little, since Diane liked to offer opinions, even when she didn't really have any. It unnerved her more that Diane was staying so motionless, hadn't found a project, something to straighten or rearrange, because Diane was a doer. She never just sat and talked.
"Patty, I got to tell you something I heard. And my first instinct was to not say anything, because of course it's not true. But you're a mom. You should know, and, hell, I don't know. You should just know."
"Okay." Has Ben ever played with the girls in a way that someone might get confused about? Patty just stared. "In a way that people might get the wrong idea about. Sexually." Patty almost choked. "Ben hates the girls." She was surprised at the relief she felt. "He has as little to do with them as possible." Diane lit another cigarette, gave a taut nod of her head.
"Well, okay. Good. But there's something more. A friend of mine told me a rumor that there's been a complaint about Ben over at the school, that a few little girls, Michelle's age or so, had talked about kissing him and maybe him touching them or something. Maybe worse. The stuff I heard was worse."
"Ben? You realize that's completely crazy."
Patty stood up, couldn't figure out what to do with her arms or legs.
She turned to the right and then to the left too quickly, like a distracted dog, and sat back down. A strap in her chair broke. I do know it's crazy, or some misunderstanding. That was the worst word Diane could have said. As soon as she said it, Patty knew she'd been dreading just exactly that. That wedge of possibility. Misunderstanding. That could turn this into something. A pat on the head, might be a caress of the back, might be a kiss on the lips, might be the roof caving in. Misunderstanding. Ben wouldn't misunderstand a kiss. Or touching. Not with a little girl. He's not a pervert. He's an odd kid, but he's not sick. He's not crazy. Patty had spent her life swearing Ben wasn't odd, just an average kid. But now she'd settle for odd. The realization came suddenly, a wild jolt, like having your hair blown in your face while driving. "Will you tell them he wouldn't do that?" Patty asked. And the tears came all at once. Suddenly her cheeks were soaked. "I can tell everyone in Kinnicky, everyone in the state of Kansas, that he wouldn't do that. And it might not be the end of it." "I don't know. I don't know. I just heard yesterday afternoon. But it seems to be getting bigger. I almost came out here. Then I spent the rest of the night convincing myself that it wasn't anything. Then I woke up this morning and realized it was." Patty knew that feeling, a dream hangover, like when she jumped up from a panicky sleep at 2 in the morning and tried to talk herself into thinking the farm was okay, that this year would pick up, and then felt all the sicker when she woke up to the alarm a few hours later, guilty and duped. It was surprising that you could spend hours in the middle of the night pretending things were okay, and know in 30 seconds of daylight that that simply wasn't so. "So you came over here with groceries and a sticker book, and all along you had this story about Ben you were going to tell me." "Like I said," Diane shrugged sympathetically, splayed her fingers except for the ones holding the cigarette. "Well, what happens now? Do you know the girls' names? Is someone going to phone me or talk to me? Or talk to Ben? I need to find Ben."
"Where is he?"
"I don't know. We had a fight. About his hair. He took off on his bike."
"So, what was the story with his hair?"
"I don't know, Diane. What in God's name does it matter now?" But of course Patty knew it did matter. Everything now would be filtered and sifted for meaning. "Well, I don't think this is an emergency," Diane said quietly.
"I don't think we need to get him home right now unless you want him home right now."
"I want him home right now."
"Okay. Well, let's start calling people then. You can give me a list of his friends and I'll start phoning."
"I don't even know his friends anymore," Patty said. "He was talking to someone this morning, but he wouldn't say who."
"Let's hit redial."
Her sister grunted, stamped out her cigarette with a boot, pulled Patty out of her chair, led her inside. Diane snapped at the girls to stay in their room when the bedroom door cracked, and made her way to the phone, purposefully hit the redial button with one brout-sized finger. Sing-song numeric tones blared out of the receiver. Beep, 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 bup, beep. And before it even rang, Diane hung up.
"My number."
"Oh, yeah. I called after breakfast to see when you'd be over." The two sisters sat at the table, and Diane poured more mugs of coffee. The snow glared into the kitchen like a strobe light. "We need to get Ben home," Patty said.
Libby Day, now. Mooney as a grade school girl, I drove home thinking about Ben. Since I was 7, I pictured him in the same haunted house flashes. Ben, black-haired, smooth-faced, with his hands clasped around an axe, charging down the hall at Debbie, a humming noise coming from his tight lips. Ben's face speckled in blood, howling, the shotgun going up to his shoulder. I'd forgotten there was once just Ben, shy and serious, those weird, unsettling blasts of humor. Just Ben, my brother, who couldn't have done what they said, what I said. At a stoplight, my blood sizzling, I reached behind my seat and grabbed the envelope from an old bill. Above the plastic window, I wrote, "Suspects." Then I wrote, "Runner." Then I stopped. "Someone with a grudge against Runner," I wrote. "Someone Runner owed money to?" Runner, Runner, Runner. It came back to Runner. That male voice bellowing in our house that night, that could have been Runner, or an enemy of Runner's as easily as it was Ben. I needed this to be true, and provable. I had a gust of panic. I can't live with this, Ben in jail, this open-ended guilt. I needed it finished. I needed to know. Me, me. I was still predictably selfish. As I passed the turnoff for our farm, I refused to look. I stopped in a 7-Eleven on the outskirts of Kansas City, filled up with gas, bought a log of Velveeta, some Coke, white bread, and kibble for my old, starving cat. Then I drove home to over there that way, pulled up my slope of a hill, got out, and stared at the two old ladies across the street who'd never look at me. They sat on the porch swing, as always, despite the chill, their heads rigidly straight, lest I muddy their view. I stood with my hands on my hips, on top of my hill, and waited until one finally caved. Then I waved, rather grandly, an Old West Corral sort of wave. The wrinkled biddy nodded at me, and I went inside and fed poor Buck, feeling a bubble of triumph. While I still had the energy, I knifed bright yellow mustard onto my white bread, stacked thick, smushy chunks of Velveeta on top, and swallowed the sandwich while negotiating with three different but equally bored phone operators to reach the Burt Nolan group home for men. That's another thing to add to my list of potential occupations for old Jim Jeffries. Operator. As a kid, that was something little girls wanted to be when they grew up, an operator. But I couldn't remember why. A thin layer of bread pasted to the roof of my mouth, I finally reached a voice at the Burt Nolan home and was surprised to find it was Burt Nolan himself. I'd assumed anyone with a home named after him must be dead. I told him I was trying to find Runner Day, and he paused.
"Well, he's been in and out, mostly out the past month, but I'd be happy to give him a message," Burt Nolan said in a voice like an old car horn.
I gave my name, no recognition on his part, and started to give my phone number when Nolan interrupted me.
"Oh, he's not going to be able to phone long distance, I can tell you that right now. The men here tend to be big corresponders. By mail, you know. Less than 50 cents for a stamp, and you don't have to worry about waiting in line for the phone. You want to leave your address?"
I did not. I shivered at the idea of Runner clomping up my steps with his overstacked dress boots, his grimy hands around his little waist, grinning like he'd beaten me at a game.
"If you want, I can take any message you have, and you can give me your address privately,"
Burt Nolan said, reasonably.
"And once Runner finishes his letter to you, I can mail it for him, and he'll never even know your zip code. A lot of family members do it that way. It's a sad but necessary thing."
In the background, a soda machine rattled out a soda pop. Someone asked Nolan if he wanted one, and he said,
"No, thanks, trying to cut back,"
in the kindly voice of a town doctor.
"You want to do that, miss? Otherwise, it'll be hard to reach him. Like I said, he's not really one to sit by the phone and wait for you to call back."
"And there's no email?" Burt Nolan grunted.
No email, I'm afraid."
I'd never known Runner to be much of a letter writer, but he always wrote more than he phoned, so I guessed that would be my best shot, short of driving down to Oklahoma and waiting on one of Burt Nolan's cots.
Would you tell him I need to talk about Ben and that night? I can come down to see him if he just gives me a day.
Okay. You said Ben and that night?
I did. I knew Lyle would be too smug about my turnaround, semi-possible potential turnaround, on Ben. I could picture him addressing the Kill Club groupies in one of his weird, tight jackets, explaining how he convinced me to go see Ben.
She was really refusing at first. I think she was scared of what she might discover about Ben, and about herself.
And all those faces looking up at him, so happy about what he'd done. It irritated me. Who I wanted to talk to was Aunt Diane. Diane, who'd taken care of me for 7 of my 11 years as an underage orphan. She'd been the first to take me in, shuffling me into her mobile home with my suitcase of belongings. Clothes, a favorite book, but no toys. Michelle hoarded all the dolls with her at night. She called it her slumber party, and she peed on them when she was strangled. I still remember a sticker book Diane had given us the day of the murders, flowers and unicorns and kittens, and always wondered if it had been in that ruined pile. Diane couldn't afford a new place. All the money from my mom's life insurance went to get Ben a decent lawyer. Diane said my mother would want that, but she said it with a drawn face, like she'd give my mother a good talking to, if she could. So no money for us. Being runty, I was able to sleep in a storage closet where the washer-dryer would have gone. Diane even painted it for me. She worked overtime, shuttled me to Topeka for therapy, tried to be affectionate with me, even though I could tell it hurt her to hug me, this pissy reminder of her sister's murder. Her arms encircled me like a hula hoop, like it was a game to get them around me but touch as little as possible. But every single morning, she told me she loved me. Over the next 10 years, I totaled her car twice, broke her nose twice, stole and sold her credit cards, and killed her dog. It was the dog that finally broke her. She'd gotten Gracie, a mop-haired mutt, not long after the murders. It was yappy and the size of Diane's forearm, and Diane liked her more than me, or so I felt. For years, I was jealous of that dog, watching Diane brush Gracie, her big manly hands wrapped around a pink plastic comb, watching her barrette Gracie's tasseled fur, watching her whip out a photo of Gracie from her wallet instead of me. The dog was obsessed with my foot, the bad one, with only 2 toes, the second and the pinky, skinny, gnarled things. Gracie was always smelling at them, like she knew they were wrong somehow. It did not endear her to me. I'd been grounded for something the summer between sophomore and junior year, and while Diane worked, I sat in the hot trailer getting angrier and angrier with that dog, the dog getting feistier and feistier. I refused to walk it, so it resorted to running in frantic loops from the sofa to the kitchen to the closet, yipping the whole time, nipping at my feet. As I coiled up, nursing my fury, pretending to watch a soap opera but instead letting my brain turn good and red, Gracie paused in one of her loops and bit at the pinky toe on my bad foot, just grabbed onto it with her canines and shook. I remember thinking, if this dog takes one of my last toes, and then getting enraged at how ridiculous I was. On my left hand was a stump where a man would never put a wedding ring, and my unsupported right foot gave me a permanent sailor's gait in a landlocked town. The girls at school called my finger a nubbin. That was worse. It sounded both quaint and grotesque at the same time, something to giggle at while looking quickly away. A physician had recently told me the amputations probably weren't even necessary. Just an overambitious country doctor. I grabbed Gracie around her middle, feeling her rib cage, that chilly tremble of a little thing. The tremble only made me angrier, and suddenly I was ripping her off my toe, the flesh going with her, and throwing her as hard as I could toward the kitchen.
She hit the pickaxe edge of the counter and collapsed in a twitching pile, bleeding all over the linoleum. I hadn't meant to kill her, but she died, not as quickly as I'd have liked, but within about 10 minutes as I paced around the trailer, trying to figure out what to do. When Diane came home, bearing an offertory of fried chicken, Gracie was still lying on the floor, and all I could say was, "She bit me." I tried to say more, to explain why it wasn't my fault, but Diane just held up a single, shaking finger.
"Don't."
She called her best friend, Valerie, a woman as delicate and motherly as Diane was bulky and bluff. Diane stood hunched over the sink, looking out the window as Valerie folded Gracie into a special blanket. Then they huddled behind a closed bedroom door and emerged, Valerie standing silently next to Diane, teary and kneading, as Diane told me to pack my things. In retrospect, I assume Valerie must have been Diane's girlfriend. Every night, Diane would climb in bed and talk to her on the phone till she fell asleep. They conferred on everything together, and even had the exact same gently feathered wash-and-wear haircut. At the time, I didn't care who she was to Diane. I lived my last two high school years with a polite couple in Abilene who were twice removed somethings and whom I only mildly terrorized. From then on, every few months, Diane would phone. I'd sit with her on the line, all heavy telephone buzz and Diane's smoky breathing into the receiver. I'd picture the bottom half of her mouth hanging there, the peach fuzz on her chin, and that mole perched near her bottom lip, a flesh-colored disc that she once told me, cackling, would grant wishes if I rubbed it. I'd hear a creak squeak in the background and knew Diane was opening the middle cabinet in the kitchen of her trailer. I knew that place better than I did the farmhouse. Diane and I would make unnecessary noises, pretend to sneeze or cough. And then Diane would say, "Hold on, Libby," pointlessly, since neither of us had been talking. Valerie would usually be there, and they'd murmur to each other, Valerie's voice coaxing, Diane's a grumble. And then Diane would give me about 20 more seconds of conversation and make an excuse to go. She stopped taking my calls when Brand New Day came out. Her only words, "What possessed you to do such a thing?" which was prim for Diane, but filled with more hurt than 36 fuck yous. I knew Diane would be at the same number. She was never going to move. The trailer was attached to her like a shell. I spent 20 minutes digging through piles at my house, looking for my old address book, one I'd had since grade school, with a pigtailed red-headed girl on the cover that someone must have thought looked like me. Except for the smile. Diane's number was filed under A, for Aunt Diane, her name inked in purple marker in my balloon animal cursive. What tone to take, and what explanation for calling? Partly, I just wanted to hear her wheeze into the phone, her football coach voice bellowing in my ear. "Well, why did it take you so long to phone back?" Partly, I wanted to hear what she really thought about Ben. She'd never railed against Ben to me. She'd always been very careful about how she spoke of him, another thing I owed her retroactive thanks for. I dialed the number, my shoulders pulling up to my ears, my throat getting tight, holding my breath and not realizing it until the third ring, when it went to the answering machine and I was suddenly exhaling. It was Valerie's voice on the machine, asking me to leave a message for her or Diane. Hi, guys. This is Libby. Just wanted to say hi and let you all know I'm still alive, and I hung up. Dialed back. "Please ignore that last message. It's Libby. I called to say I'm sorry for, oh, a lot of things, and I'd like to talk." I trailed on in case anyone was screening, then left my number, hung up, and sat on the edge of my bed, poised to get up, but having no reason to. I got up. I'd done more this day than the previous year. While I still held the phone, I made myself call Lyle, hoping for voicemail and, as usual, getting him. Before he could annoy me, I told him the meeting with Ben had gone fine and I was ready to hear who he believed was the killer. I said this all in a very precise tone, like I was doling out information with a measuring spoon.
"I knew you'd like him. I knew you'd come around," he crowed, and once again I pleased myself by not hanging up.
"I didn't say that, Lyle. I said I was ready for another assignment, if you want." We met again at Tim Clark's Grill, the place cloudy with grease. Another old waitress, or else the same one with a red wig, hustled around on spongy tennis shoes, her miniskirt flapping around her, looking like an ancient tennis pro. Instead of the fat man admiring his new vase, a table of hipster dudes were passing around 70s-era nudie playing cards and laughing at the big bushes on the women. Lyle was sitting tightly at a table next to them, his chair turned awkwardly away. I sat down with him, poured a beer from his pitcher.
"So, was he what you expected? What did he say?" Lyle started, his leg jittering.
I told him, except for the part about the porcelain bunny.
"See what Magda meant, though? About him being hopeless?"
I did. "I think he's made peace with the prison sentence," I said, an insight I shared only because the guy had given me $300 and I wanted more. "He thinks it's penance for not being there to protect us or something. I don't know. I thought when I told him about my testimony, about it being exaggerated, that he'd jump on it, but nothing."
"Legally, it's maybe not that helpful after this long," Lyle said. "Magda says if you want to help Ben, we should compile more evidence, and you can recant your testimony when we file for habeas corpus. It'll make more of a splash. It's more political than legal at this point. A lot of people made big careers on that case."
Magda seems to know a lot.
She heads up this group called the Free Day Society, all about getting Ben out of prison. I sometimes go, but it seems mostly for, fans. Women.
"You ever hear of Ben with a serious girlfriend? One of those free day women whose name is Molly or Sally or Polly? He had a tattoo."
"No Sallys. Polly seems like a pet's name. My cousin had a dog named Polly. One Molly, but she's 70 or so."
A plate of fries appeared in front of him, the waitress definitely different from our previous one, just as old but much friendlier. I like waitresses who call me hun or sweetie, and she did. Lyle ate fries for a while, squeezing packets of ketchup on the side of the plate, then salting and peppering the ketchup, then dipping each fry individually and placing it in his mouth with girlish care.
"Well, so tell me who you think did it," I finally nudged. "Who what?"
I rolled my eyes and set my head in my hands as if it was too much for me, and it almost was.
"Oh, right. I think Lou Cates, Chrissy Cates's dad, did it."
He leaned back in his chair with satisfaction, as if he'd just won a game of Clue. Chrissy Cates. The name jangled something. I tried to fake Lyle out, but it didn't work.
"You do know who Chrissy Cates is, right?"
When I didn't say anything, he continued, his voice taking on a sleek, patronizing tone.
"Chrissy Cates was a fifth grader at your school, at Ben's school. The day your family was killed, the police were looking to question Ben. She'd accused him of molesting her."
"What?"
"Yeah."
We both stared each other down, with matching you-are-crazy looks. Lyle shook his head at me.
"When you say people don't talk to you about this stuff, you aren't kidding."
"She didn't testify against Ben," I started.
"No, no. It's the one smart thing Ben's defense did, making the case that they weren't legally linked, the molestation and the murders. But the jury was sure poisoned against him. Everyone in the area had heard that Ben had molested this nice little girl from this nice family, and that was probably what led up to his satanic murders. You know how rumors go."
So did the Chrissy Cates thing ever go to trial? I asked. Did they prove Ben did anything wrong with her?